From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made this past weekend on the front page of the New York Times, and it came with a headline. In the shopping cart of a food stamp household, lots of soda. It also came with a photo. That photo showed a shopping cart in a grocery store, and almost everything in it was 2-liter bottles of soda. And the impression was clear. If you're just walking by the street, you see the paper. If you're on food stamps or SNAP, you're spending most of your money on soda. Well, the article focused on a study that the author claimed showed that SNAP recipients spend more on sugary drinks than Americans who are not on SNAP. But critics have pointed out numerous flaws in the story, from errors in the data to the way it kind of shames people in poverty over the choices they make. And here's what we know. We all buy a lot of sugary drinks as a population, SNAP or not. We also know that the food purchases in SNAP households aren't all that different, really, compared to non-SNAP households. And it's worth asking how we can make healthy food more accessible for everyone. So let's talk about that this hour. My guests include Mitch Gruber, who's the Chief Program Officer for FoodLink. Always nice to see you, Mitch. Welcome back.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Mike Bulger's here. Mike's Healthy Communities Coordinator for the Healthy Kids Program at Finger Lakes Health Systems Agency. Mike, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And Leverett Copeland's here. Leverett's a SNAP recipient and kind of a healthy living ambassador. That's a pretty cool title to have, by the way.
Thank you.
It's nice to see you back here, Leverett. You got a big smile on your face at that.
Nice to be back.
Is that an official title for you?
I guess so.
You'll take it?
I'll take it.
Leverett, in your neighborhood, buying food for you, the easiest way to do that is to go where?
It's to go to grocery stores, but a lot of people don't have access. Myself, I don't have a vehicle, so we have to take a cab or get a cab if we have the money for a cab. Otherwise, we have to go to corner stores.
Okay, and how would you characterize the quality of the food and the health quality of the food from corner stores?
Well, the quality of the food is not great. Prices are cheap for the more sugary and unhealthy foods. For the healthier foods, it's expensive. It costs a little bit too much, or they don't have access to it.
But, you know, I know you care about your family, your kids. You think about choices you have to make. Sometimes you have to make hard calls about what you can kind of fit in. I mean, what's the mindset when you're trying to figure out, you know, what am I going to spend this on?
Basically, we try to more health-wise. And trying to get as much, because I have 2 young boys. They eat a lot, quite a lot. So we try to do quality and quantity, but a lot of times you have to do less quality to get more. Like I said, I have a 15-year-old boy. He can sit there and eat 3 packs of noodles in one time. So I have to buy cheaper food, and a lot of times that healthier food or the healthier component is more expensive. I can't afford it.
Okay, and Mitch, that's that statement right there represents the core of, I think, the work that you do, but also the discussion in this country on, you know, why is it that cheaper food is often the sugary stuff, the stuff that's not as healthy? And that's a story you've heard many times, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that what's important to note is it's multifaceted, the problem. I mean, I think it starts from the federal level, and I'm sure Mike can speak more to this, but just the way that the Farm Bill subsidizes the ingredients that constitute most of our sugary processed foods. But on top of that, then you have the distribution channels as well. I mean, Leverett and I were talking on the way over here about the types of distributors that end up going into a lot of the corner stores. And they are there, they're pushing the Fritos, the Hershey bars, and the soda. And they're not offering a lot of the same other quality food that is available at some of the big box supermarkets.
Okay. What do you think, Mike?
That's absolutely right. It does, you know, have a lot of origins in decisions that are made on the federal level as far as what types of crops to insure and subsidize. And then also it comes down to the fact that these highly processed foods are very shelf stable and there's a high profit margin. Sugar's really cheap, and so is a lot of the other, you know, processed ingredients. And so there's an incentive for the distribution chain from the farm to the store to stock and sell things that end up not being very good for our health.
I want to, first things first, make sure we understand the reality of what the New York Times reported. And so let's kind of just get that out of the way here. I think a lot of people either saw the headline or read the story and they thought, oh, people who are utilizing SNAP are spending a lot or most of it on soda. Not true. There were a couple of numbers that were conflated. It turns out the actual numbers based on the study are, let's say you're spending $100 on SNAP recipients will spend about $5 on soda. The average American will spend almost $5 on soda.
Right.
Very little difference. If you roll that into all sugary drinks, a SNAP recipient will spend about $9.25 out of 100 on sugary drinks. The average American, almost $8. I mean, so there's very, Mitch, to me, that's, the difference is 1 or 2%.
Yeah, it was very surprising to see the way the Times slanted some of this data. I don't quite understand what the motive or impetus was there. But both Mike and I, both organizations, we work with a group called Collaborative Health Research, and I just had some communications with them, and they had read the study. They sent me over one of the key tables, and it shows that the differences are incredibly negligible in the actual USDA study. I don't think anyone disputes the fact that we as a nation eat and drink too much sugary stuff. I don't think anyone disputes that. But for some reason, this article slanted to say that's unique to the SNAP-eligible household when the data suggests otherwise.
Lever, is there, when you see a story like that, an article like that, does it, do you feel stigmatized at all? I mean, does it hit you in any different way? I hope it doesn't. And then my concern in reading that is exactly what Mitch is talking about, that it makes this distinction that, first of all, the data doesn't support, and second of all, I'm worried about stigma. How do you feel about it?
I personally ignore it because mm-hmm. I know the truth. I live every day in society. I try to buy non-sugary drinks for my kids. I've been doing it for years. It costs me 3 times as much if I buy them sodas than the non-sugary drinks, the drinks that's good for them. So I know that in my neighborhood, a lot of people don't drink sodas. If we're gonna buy soda more time because it's cheaper, we use cash. We're not gonna use the SNAP benefits. We try to use that for more essential items in our household, the seasoning, the rice, meat, things that are needed. A lot of times, not even meat. We try to buy things that are needed to help us get by for the month. That is what SNAP is for. We try not to use it for sugary drinks because we know we can get that with the cash. And its access is right there at the corner store. When we do get to the grocery store, we're trying to get things that are healthy and wholesome, something that's going to feed our family and make sure, because we have growing kids, and we're trying to make sure that they have the advantages that everybody else has.
Yeah, absolutely. But Mike, here's an email I got this morning as I was kind of discussing this story in various platforms. I got a note from a listener named Alan who says, "Evan, even if the Times story is flawed, it doesn't change my view that if my tax dollars are paying for someone else's food, I don't want it to be junk food. Is that so wrong? Can't we set new rules on what can and cannot be purchased?" That's from Alan. What do you think, Mike?
I think that's, you know, that's the burning question, and it's been around for about as long as food stamps have been around. It was, you know, foreseen when it was first debated in the Senate to revive the food stamp program that sugary sweetened beverages would become a liability and used as propaganda against the program. And I think there's some valid questions that need to be asked about, you know, where we're steering money from the USDA. And if it's going into the bank accounts of companies that are working hard to push unhealthy products in poor neighborhoods and to minority populations and in the developing world, and that's showing up in our doctor's office and our hospitals with type 2 diabetes and obesity. You know, is that really what we want to be doing with not only SNAP, but our schools and our lunchrooms and our other nutrition programs?
Okay. Mitch, how do you feel about Alan's email?
You know, I think this is something I've been thinking about long and hard, both academically and professionally at FoodLink. And I think there is a larger conversation that we have to have about the way tax dollars are spent. But the issue is not how people use their SNAP benefits. It is the fact, in my opinion, that when we allocate things like SNAP and WIC, we're still ultimately depending on private sector businesses to provide the services that allow people to use those unhealthy food. That's not happening. The last time I was in the studio with you, we were talking about the closing of Constantino's. And the sad reality is we have very limited supermarkets in this city, and it's not changing anytime soon. So if the corner store is where people are going to use their SNAP benefits, then we're probably going to see people keep using it on a lot of things that maybe Alan doesn't want. I agree with Alan. Let's start figuring out ways using our tax dollars to change the food landscape in places that have no supermarkets.
What's the first thing we should do then?
I think that we ought to figure out a way to replicate models like one that I just visited in Philadelphia called Fair and Square Market. It's a nonprofit-run supermarket. I think our curbside market, which is serving about 25, 30,000 individuals per year, is a nonprofit entity that is mission-driven. Foodlink is a mission-driven organization that wants to do the work that allows Leverett to buy easier, that allows the health systems agency to see health improvements. It's not a profit-driven enterprise. We need to see more of those opportunities arise.
Okay. Mike, what do you think?
I would say that those definitely have a place. And furthermore, I think I'd like to see our nonprofit sector and our private sector and our healthcare sector come together to create viable business opportunities so that we're not just reliant upon grants and what forth to promote healthy foods. That's something that we're trying to do at Finger Lakes Health Systems Agency. In partnership with Foodlink, we're going to bring together stakeholders from the region's rural areas and healthcare sectors and researchers and try to explore common ground for, finding more than one solution to this. Because as Mitch said at the top of the hour, it's really multifaceted. And it's I sort of liken it to turning around an ocean liner. It's not going to happen on a dime, and it's going to take a lot of effort.
I'm listening to a number of listeners weigh in on this, and let me just say some of them are directing me to a Media Matters article. There's a number of articles that are sort of rebuttals to the New York Times story. There's one by Joe Soss titled Food Stamp Fables. And if you want to check that out, Megan Mack and I can post that on our Twitter feeds if you want to find it. Because I think you ought to, if you're going to read the New York Times story, you ought to read the rebuttal. I think, and the biggest problem I had right out of the gate was that photo. Because a lot of the people who don't read the article will see the photo, and the photo is a shopping cart filled with soda, almost nothing else. And that's just not at all the story. That really bothered. Shouldn't it have bothered me, Mitch?
Yeah, I'm glad it bothered you, and I'm glad we're having this conversation.
And Rebecca writes to the program and says, please tell Alan, your emailer, to get over himself. Stop being so judgmental about other people's lives. Try being more generous. People are in need. Help them. Full stop. That's from Rebecca. I take the point, Rebecca. I mean, I think Alan is expressing what he would probably, I don't want to speak for him. I think he would probably say he wants what's best for everybody. He doesn't want to see, people in bad health. But again, part of the problem is, I think Alan is coming in from the lens of this New York Times story as if there's much of a difference between SNAP recipients and people who are not SNAP recipients, and there's very little difference. It's really a healthy eating question and a healthy access question across the board. You can call the program again if you want to. It's 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. So, Mitch, tell me a little bit more then about curbside and about sort of how you kind of got to know Leverett. I mean, this is somebody who you thought would be a great fit for this conversation because of his concern about his kids and finding access to healthy food, even when it can be difficult. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I think the story of how Leverett and I met, it actually loops Mike right in too. So it's kind of a great example. About 6 years ago, Miguel Melendez, who runs Project Hope, which is part of Ibero, and myself at Foodlinks, and Julia Tedesco started a farm stand over at the corner of Clifford and Conkey because there were not farmers markets and because the corner stores were not selling anything fresh. So we started, and the program really grew because neighbors like Leverett, although we didn't see him the first year, I'm not sure you were in the neighborhood quite yet, but neighbors like Leverett started coming to the farm stand and saying, oh, we really wanted an opportunity to be able to buy this stuff. We took food stamp or SNAP benefits, and we run several programs that incentivize SNAP. So if you spend $5, we can actually double it and give you an additional $5. That's a federal program. So we started working on this, and over the years, the neighborhood has really sustained this farm stand. Project Hope still runs it. And on top of that, organizations like Leverett's Basketball Camp, Nurse Bowick's Conkey Cruisers have really started to put some type of pressure on the corner store in the area. And then the Finger Lakes Health Systems Agency came in and offered some technical support. And now we're seeing, and I think these two can speak better to it than I can, that one of the corner stores in the neighborhood is actually starting to incorporate more healthy foods into the neighborhood, which is exactly why we started the program.
All right, Lever, you want to add to that?
Well, basically, he's right. We put pressure on the corner store. He brought in more fruit and vegetables. He also saw that Teresa Bolick, who's Conky Cruz's captain, wouldn't let any of the kids come on the park with anything sugary. Sugary drinks.
Contraband
is what she calls it. And also, I saw a need with my basketball program. I saw a need to get kids into college, but also had a problem with nutrition. It's kind of hard to get a kid to play basketball when he's not eating properly at home. So we also start working with Mitch and with the corner store with Finger Lakes, not only with Michael, but other individuals, to try to do a program where we can do to change the ideas of diet. So as they're on SNAP, we know their parents on SNAP, to try to give their parents an insight on a healthy way to live, but at more economical cost. Because now we're getting programs like Mitch coming in and Mike coming in to work with the corner stores who are bringing in cheaper and healthier foods now.
Okay, Mike?
Yeah, working with the corner stores is really a unique challenge. Mitch, you know, alluded to it and we spoke about it earlier. A lot of the reason why they stock so many unhealthy foods and so few healthy foods has to do with the economics of the distribution chain and the folks who contact them. A lot of these store owners are the only folks who run their store. They might be operating at a very thin margin, and taking on fresh produce is a big risk. So trying to assist them in gaining knowledge about how to properly store these, how to add value to them, by turning them into prepared food or fruit smoothies or things like that is a challenge. But there's also a lot of opportunity to be had out there. I think that there's an appetite, pardon the pun, for healthy foods in a lot of the neighborhoods that lack them. It's about finding the right way to get them in there, whether it's a nonprofit grocery store or working with some of these smaller business owners that are already embedded in the community.
And to address your direct question about curbside, I would be remiss to not go into that program a little bit. In fact, Evan, the last time I was on here, we got a slew of curbside volunteers. So I'm saying it again, if anyone does want to volunteer on curbside market,
you never miss an opportunity.
foodlinkny.org, you can go sign up there with Eric.
Well, what's it mean to be a curbside volunteer?
Yeah, so the curbside market is a program that is specifically meant to address the lack of farmers markets and supermarkets in various communities, both in Rochester and in our rural areas as well. We go to local farms and we buy produce from all sorts of farmers, all sorts of products. In the wintertime, we start buying from mostly distributors. So it is a year-round program. We go local in the summer, in the growing season, and we go non-local in the winter. We take these fresh fruits, vegetables, and eggs. We load it up into about an 18 to 20 foot step van. We have three vehicles now. One of them is wheelchair accessible, which is exciting. And we go around to public housing facilities, community health centers, YMCAs, areas that we know there's a large concentration of poverty and a large concentration of individuals who are really struggling to access fresh fruits and vegetables. Not only do we bring the product to them, but on top of that, we also make it cheaper by using our purchasing power. And even better, as I'm sure Leverett can speak to, we also use a government incentive program called the Double Up Food Bucks, where people can double their dollars. They can't do this anywhere else in the community, only on the curbside market. They come on. If you come on, Evan, with your SNAP card and you spend $5 on various produce, I give you a coupon for an additional $5. And that is where the federal government, I think, has some really excellent programs to incentivize. The other side of this New York Times article is that not only do we need to make more food accessible, but there's value in having incentive programs to use SNAP dollars in healthy food. Because in the end, the public dollars are there for the SNAP. They're also there on the healthcare side. So if we can incentivize folks to start eating healthier, it's going to have a serious ripple effect down the line on our taxpayer dollars.
All right, I'm going to get to your phones in a second. Leverett, though, can you speak a little bit to that? I mean, do you use that opportunity to kind of double up the dollars there?
Oh, yes, I do, and my neighbors do also. Right now, it's January. They're already asking when the curbside market is going to be there. They come in droves. They like to buy the fruits, the vegetables, especially the kids, because they bug the parents. They get the little cars. Well, we can double up on it. And when they say double up on it, people love value. And then they see that it's healthy, and it gives them that excitement, and I love it.
Yeah. I'm sorry to prevent you from going to the phone, but just wait. He mentioned kids, and this is something that very excites me. Flo Clemens, who runs the program for us, told me the other day, we are working on schools with the health system agency. We go to how many schools is it, Mike?
Five?
We're going to five schools with curbside, RCSD schools. And the experience of having kids come on the vehicle after getting nutrition education in the classroom and learning about what these different items are and having kids buy this stuff, that's how we're going to see some change. It's going to be generational. To Mike's point, we're not turning this thing around overnight. But if we get kids to start thinking about eating healthy and what that means to them and their bodies, we've done a really good thing.
You seen it, Leverett?
Oh, yes. I see it with my own kids and with the kids in my program. They love to eat healthy. They love that it's going to make them better. And they see the problems that our generation is having with the obesity and the sodas.
Yeah. All right. Let me grab our first phone call. This is down in Union Springs. Carlo, first up. Go ahead, Carlo.
Hi, Evan. Thank you.
Sure.
I'd like to say, first of all, I applaud this whole idea of getting healthy food out to the people who might not have been exposed to it. I split my time between here in New York City and the green. The farmers markets are all over the boroughs, and they do take food stamps. I did want to go back to the initial story. You guys keep saying sugary drinks. The truth is, these drinks have corn sweetener. Sugar is not cheap. If you get a soft drink that's just sugar and flavoring, it's a little 8-ounce bottle. It's fairly expensive. It's good too. Corn sweetener is very cheap. It deep history, we started doing this when the Cuban Revolution happened because you couldn't get sugar. So we're subsidizing the corn sweetener, which is grown by all these conservative, self-reliant farmers in the Midwest. I'm being sarcastic, excuse me. We're also subsidizing ethanol, so now we have gas guzzlers with ethanol. So the point is, these drinks are huge because that stuff is so cheap. And it's a bigger vehicle for advertising, that big bottle when you see it up on the shelf. So it all sort of works together. And as far as, I know I work with younger guys who drink this stuff, and I see some of them drink two or three 16-ounce bottles in an 8-hour day. And I just wonder what's going to happen to these guys when they're 50 or 60. So I just wanted to put that little point of fact in is the cheapness of it is enables the volume. And if the stuff was cost more for a smaller bottle, it'd be a different situation.
Carlo, okay. Thanks for the phone.
Thank you.
Thanks, Carlo. First of all, Mike, you agree with that? And second of all, is that because we're making a policy choice? Is that a food policy that this country has made that has paved the way for cheap soda, cheap junk food?
Yes, that's the short answer. Is yes. To the caller's point, we say sugary sweetened, but a lot of these sugars are derived from processing corn, mm-hmm. And they're not cane sugar as you might think of it, or even beet sugar. And here in this region, we actually have a lot of corn crops, and most of the corn in this country is processed into either livestock feed or high fructose corn syrup or ethanol. And that is in place in large part because of the safety net that's provided for those growers and those crops through the Farm Bill, and the lack of a similar incentive program for specialty crops, so-called specialty crops, which are, broccoli, apples, strawberries, the things that grow really well around here, and we do have a lot of great growers. But I would say that they are. If I was a farmer and I was in it just to make money, I would probably steer away from the specialty crops myself.
Sure. And that's so reflective of the problem that ultimately. We label specialty the Farm Bill. We think of farms, we think of food, but those are specialty crops. And the corn, the wheat, and the soy that is all going into these products that end up being very cheap are really what the Farm Bill covers and subsidizes. And it makes it really, really difficult. I mean, I do sometimes villainize the store owners. That's where I think Leverett and Mike and I disagree. I've been kind of jaded over the years by a bunch of corner store owners. But I will say the system at hand that makes certain foods cheap and certain foods expensive, that impacts everyone down the line. It makes it just generally hard to distribute healthy food.
Okay, before I go back to the phones then, we're talking about systems, we're talking about profits, we're talking about incentives. I mean, Trish on Twitter is making the same point Carlo just made. She said, maybe you can limit SNAP if you limit sugar subsidies. And she says, you got to talk about fair trade food pricing and why highly processed foods are so cheap because of government subsidies. So, but you brought up the fact that, you know, or I think both of you brought up the fact that maybe nonprofit grocery stores, maybe a different kind of a model here. And again, you know, you go back to making a values choice as a society. How do you afford that? And do you decide we have to afford that? That if we just rely on a for-profit model, is it going to choose, you know, is it going to choose bad outcomes? What do you think, Mitch?
Well, Evan, I think a lot about that. I think
do we have a couple of hours?
I think here? I bet my advisor's listening. I just finished my dissertation at the U of R, which is largely really about this exact topic in a lot of ways. And I firmly believe that we really should think about food distribution as a public utility. We did as a country for a long time. Of course, it was the progressive era. We thought about a lot of things as a public utility, but it makes a whole lot of sense to think about our municipality and our county having a responsibility to make sure that everybody has a fair and just food climate. And we don't think about it that way. We think about food as strictly in the hands of the private sector. And I understand why that's the case, but I do think that we're going to start to see some things change. You look at the Constantino's example that we talked about last time. That was, talk about a waste of taxpayer dollars. That's a waste of taxpayer dollars. Setting up a store in a place where we knew it was doomed to fail because Wegmans had walked out just a few years before. That's wasting dollars. A better opportunity, I believe, is figuring out how to get a mission-driven organization. And yes, do I want Foodlink to be at the table? Absolutely, but it doesn't have to be Foodlink. It could be a brand new organization that is much more collaborative in thinking about this. But let's have a mission-driven organization trying to help people access food, not a profit-driven one.
So if I have a panel on neoliberalism, you want to come talk about that?
I'm ready. I'll bring Julia with me, though.
I figured you would. Before we go into our second half hour, we'll get our only break of the hour, and then we'll come back to your phone calls here. But I want to just hit one more point before the break, which is this here. I say in this program a lot, we're evidence people. I'm an evidence guy. Show me the evidence. You know, I try not to pick a side. I just want to know what the evidence tells me. The evidence from the New York Times story does not compel us to believe that people who are struggling, people who are living in poverty or below the poverty line, are making demonstrably bad choices or irresponsible choices or are deserving of any shame. I mean, the food choices are very, very close to the same as people who are not on SNAP benefits, for example. And then you hear someone like Leverett telling you the story that when that access comes, you said it wasn't just you and your family. It was people in the neighborhood who are lining up for those markets. So if you're making an assumption that people who might be struggling or living near the poverty line aren't going to make good choices if they're offered, Leverett, the message, it sounds to me it's the opposite, isn't it?
Yes, it's totally the opposite. In my neighborhood, perfect example, the Tops we have in our neighborhood is not as close. It's not the friendliest. It's not the cleanest. But if you go to one more like Henrietta, it's more clean and it gives more opportunity. It actually offers more and the prices are cheaper. That is one issue that we have also. People that are on SNAP are in these neighborhoods that go to that Tops. They don't go to the one in Henrietta. I'm not saying that people don't, but majority of them are here. So we run into that problem not only about locality of grocery stores, but the conditions and the quality of the market when we do get to those markets. That's another problem we have also.
You're hearing Leverett Copeland, who is a basketball mentor, very active in his neighborhood, and as a SNAP recipient. Mitch Gruber is the Chief Program Officer for Foodlink, and Mike Bulger's here, Healthy Communities Coordinator for the Healthy Kids Program at Finger Lakes Health Systems Agency. Let's get our only break of the hour, and we come right back to your phone calls, which are filled up on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. On Friday, you might have heard there's a presidential inauguration taking place, and so that will preempt coverage of Connections. We'll be back with you on Monday. You can hear live inauguration coverage for incoming President Donald Trump all throughout the day on your NPR stations here on WXXI or wherever you're listening. Hope you enjoy that, and we'll talk with you Monday on member-supported public radio. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Next up on the phones is Sam in Rochester. Go ahead, Sam.
Yes, I was hearing the young man said that people that had sugary drinks was not allowed in certain parts of the program. And I wanted to ask him, how much do they know about the kid that they're denying access with the sugary drink?
So, Sam, let me just jump in and just to clarify, I think what Mitch was saying was Teresa Boak, who is a remarkable woman, who's, I think, the founder of Conky Cruisers, yes, which is this awesome organization. They do a lot of bicycling, very active, a lot of fitness. She is a little tougher on people making bad health choices. And I think the comment I heard, whether it was Leverett or Mitch, was saying, you go to the park and Nurse Boak is there. You know, she doesn't want you bringing a sugary drink into the park. Is that?
It's part of the program. You can't ride the bicycle if you're going to drink sugary drinks. She'll give you a bottle of water for that soda.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. All right. So, Sam, does that clear that up?
No. Okay. Because what do you know about the kid that has the sugary drink? You don't know where that kid, if you don't know anything about the kid and where he's come from, that may be the only thing that he has access to. So in order to deny him that kind of access, I think you need to find out something about the family and where he comes from. Because if he just take a bottle of water there while he's there and then go back and get another sugary drink, you haven't solved the problem.
We know every kid that comes in the program. Before they get in the program, we actually meet with the parents. We get to know the parents and the kids. And the majority of the kids that are in this program are not for 1 or 2 years. We've known them for 6, 7, 8 years. So we know. And we teach them to go shopping. We're just trying to teach them more healthy habits. If they do have a health problem, we know about that. If they don't have anything, we try to give them more than just that bottle of water. We try to give them food and a way to get more food.
And I'm certain that Nurse Boak would be happy to have you come see Conky Cruisers, Sam. So if you're interested, I'm sure she'd be happy to have you down there.
Well, yeah, man, the reason I bring that up, because I used to coach basketball in the CYO, and I had access to a lot of kids who came with a lot of different problems and a lot of different circumstances. And you were not only there to coach basketball, but you were there as a mentor and a counselor to those kids to make sure they got the right direction in their lives. And some kids don't have fathers and some kids don't have mothers to make sure that they have access to the proper nutrition. Because I was brought up on a farm as a sharecropper, and we had nothing but organic food. So I mean, when you said that, it just made something go off, you know, because we have to be careful with that, and do a little bit more explaining on the radio, because you really didn't explain it like you telling it to me now.
Okay, well, you know, Sam, let me just jump in and say I think all the points you're making are good points. If there was any organization in town that was so strict about healthy eating that you're literally sending kids away if they show up with a Pepsi. And you don't know anything about their lives, that would probably be a problem. But the good news is, whether it's Conky Cruisers or the work that Leverett Copeland is doing in his community, they're getting to know these families. They're building relationships. But the point, Sam, that you're making is a very good one and well taken. Elizabeth in Rochester next. Go ahead, Elizabeth.
Hi. I'm a farmer, and I wanted to comment on what you said about the subsidies making the corn cheap. Actually, from 1933 to 1953, the United States government had a policy called parity pricing for farm crops. So for corn and soybeans and wheat, tobacco, the price that was paid by the processors who were buying those products from the farms had to be in line with the rest of the economy, so that the farm could afford to buy gas for the tractor itself. Parity pricing meant that farm pricing was in line with the rest of the economy. In the 50s, our government departed from parity pricing. And if you look at the charts, the price that farmers got for corn and soybeans had been going down steadily ever since then. The subsidies make up part of that loss. But the price that the farmers are getting is often even below the cost of production. So then that subsidy keeps those farms in business, although a lot of farms have gone out of business. And that's why the farms that grow corn and soy are getting bigger and bigger as the farms that are in better shape buy up their neighbors, which is maybe satisfying for a little while for the farmers who do that, but devastating for rural communities. And why there are so many people out there in Iowa and the other small towns who are so angry that they voted way against their own interests in this past election. But the important thing to remember is that we had parity pricing and we could go back to that. And that the price was not paid by the taxpayer. It was paid by the processors who've been making tons of money buying cheap corn, cheap soybeans, and processing them and selling them, or export-import business, selling them all around the world and undercutting what farmers in other countries can afford to produce those crops for.
Yeah, I'm assuming that's Liz Henderson out there. Liz, I think you and I both agree, and I'm sure everyone around the table would agree that one of the things that's so interesting about this subject is that there are really clear policy changes that could make a world of difference. And that's something that I think we all have to grapple with. And I think we can probably safely say that over the next 4 years, it's only going to get worse. And there's going to be a new farm bill reauthorization that's going to be even tougher, for a tougher pill to swallow. But we do have to rally. We do have to mobilize and figure out how to use policy to change this, so we're not having this conversation again in 5 years.
I'm with you, Mitch. I'll work with you any day. Thank you.
Liz, thanks for calling the program. I appreciate that. Mike, you want to add anything there?
No, I think that's a really succinct insight. You know, it's an extremely complicated, you know, set of insurances, subsidies that are direct and whatnot. And it does benefit the larger scale and by that extension, the processors. And it is to the detriment of the smaller farmers. So, you know, I hesitate to make anyone's eyes glaze over with the down and dirty details, but I think that was a really good point made.
All right, Robert in Fairport. Go ahead, Robert.
Thank you for taking my call. The earlier caller that talked about corn being cheap and, you know, it's subsidized and all this kind of stuff, that's only about half the story. The reason the corn is cheap, one reason it's cheap, is that sugar is artificially expensive. Forbes wrote an article just yesterday, as a matter of fact, on the fact that we have these huge U.S. sugar tariffs that make sugar purchased in the U.S. Much more expensive because we are trying to keep out imported sugar. And this has been really a tremendously bad development for the confectionery industry in the U.S. A lot of production has moved outside the U.S. because of these sugar tariffs. So that's one reason why high fructose corn syrup is cheap, is because cane sugar is artificially expensive.
Mike, anything you want to add there?
That is true. It's it's at no cost to the American taxpayer, except that it makes candy and whatnot, and high fructose corn syrup. Candy more expensive and high fructose corn syrup less expensive. I don't know if you call that a public health wash or anything like that, but I think when we talk about it from a community standpoint and a public health standpoint, I'm not going to be calling for cheaper sugar anytime soon.
You want to add anything there, Robert?
Well, I think the problem is within the agricultural industry is that it's so skewed based on politics and policies that are designed to enrich a handful of people. The U.S. sugar lobby is very small but very influential. And there's literally been millions of jobs lost in U.S. industries because the production is cheaper to do these things overseas. And I just think that I don't know how you unravel something like that, but there's a lot of different parts to it.
Robert, thanks for the phone call.
Thank you.
Anything you want to add there, Mitch, as well?
I think it is complicated, and certainly, is it 2018, Mike, that the Farm Bill will be reauthorized? I believe it's 2018.
We'll see.
Yeah, they're at least going to start to have the conversation
in
2018.
Yeah, they're starting.
And I think it's going to be incredibly complicated, and I think it's incumbent upon us as a community and as a state and as a nation to start to figure out what we really want to see out of the Farm Bill.
Betty on Twitter writes, during the Great Depression, Ella Baker and others organized food co-ops in underserved neighborhoods. And just a note passed on from producer Megan Mack as well, that there is a rich history of African-American cooperatives and cooperative activity from the mid-1800s all the way to today, and Ella Baker was part of that. But we're talking about the Great Depression, a massive crisis. I mean, huge unemployment, people waiting in long lines for food. And sometimes I think, Mitch, we get to this point where it's like, well, you know, we're not even in a recession where, you know, we're, look at the Dow, look at everything's pretty solid right now. Right. And there's this idea that things are okay for me, or I'm not seeing widespread problems. And I'm not sure it should take a Great Depression to mobilize massive community effort around this.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, it's really interesting. So Foodlink, for anyone who doesn't know, we're the regional food bank, so we serve the emergency food system. And our numbers continue to grow every year, and I don't say that as though it's a good thing, right? That reflects a really bad trend across our region. But when I started back in 08, we were moving about 8 million pounds of food a year. We're up to just about 20 million pounds of food a year now. And it really spiked with the recession in 08, but there hasn't been a significant decline. And there's a lot of reasons why that may be, but I think one of them is that, you know, in inflation and grocery prices, there has not necessarily been a correlation, and people are now spending a higher percentage of their dollars on food than they were prior to the recession. And so we're seeing people, the working poor really, folks who have jobs, folks who aren't necessarily on SNAP benefits, but maybe they're right at the threshold, who still need the services of a food pantry or soup kitchen that we provide food to.
Let me read an email and get all of our panelists to respond. Jim writes and says, I'm a retired sales rep who called on city retailers for more than 20 years. I saw quite a bit of junk food bought with SNAP and cash in the city stores over the years. The retailers carry junk food because there's the demand for it. They don't carry fresh food because of the lack of demand. Maybe better education and lower prices for fresh food would bring up the demand. That's from Jim. I'm going to start with Leverett Copeland. What do you think, Leverett?
I personally witnessed a vendor with a corner store manager, or the corner store owner. The corner store owner was always asking for healthy foods, and the vendor was pointing him towards the less healthy, or we can give you more of this, and giving them more deals for those sugary snacks and things, because they get a lot more commission, I could guess, off the things that they sell. He was asking for rice, or we don't have rice, or we have this rice, but I can sell you this honey bun and give you more of this. Those are the kind of deals that I heard purposely that day.
Okay, and from your perspective, there's a demand that people will buy
whatever's there. They will buy whatever's there. If I send my kids to the store and if it has healthy foods, they will buy healthy foods. My granddaughter will eat a candy bar as well as an apple if you give her the choice. But you have to give them that choice. If you go to the store, there's only candy bars. Of course, that's what we're going to buy, and that's what's been put in front of us because that's what the store owners have.
Mitch,
I have a real problem with the email that came in, because the key word there is demand. I mean, what Mike and Leverett and I have all been talking about is that the supply chain makes it a lot easier to sell unhealthy food. Certainly, the requirements of selling a Twinkie, which can sit on a shelf for probably 15 years without it changing, is a lot easier than selling an apple, which you actually have to monitor and make sure there aren't fruit flies or anything associated with it. I don't believe for a second it's demand, and I have to say the curbside market is a really key indicator of that. We served last year well over 20,000 people on the curbside market. We made over $150,000 in sales, of which more than 30% were SNAP. And way more than 30% were people who have SNAP benefits, but 30% were with a SNAP card. There is no doubt in my mind that people, if given the opportunity to use their SNAP dollars in healthy food, will do it. And Leverett's the perfect example of that. When we started doing the farm stand at Conkey Corner, guess what? People started using their SNAP dollars in healthy food. But it's not demand. And pinning it on demand is the same thing the New York Times did. It villainizes the shopper, when in reality, the problem here is what's available for the shopper.
Leverett?
I know in my neighborhood, if it would by demand, that corner store would be selling a lot more Goya and a lot more collard greens. They don't sell that. That's what I demand. I know in my household, it's half Spanish, half black. And I know majority of the people that stay around me are African-American or Hispanic. But he doesn't carry Goya products or adobo or things of that nature. He carries sweets. I'm sure if he carried the adobo, because we had a sofrito garden there, it stayed empty because people were constantly picking from it and making sofrito.
Right.
So it's demanded, but he doesn't sell it. I'm sure if he sold it, we would buy it from them, but it was free, so they got it. If it's there, we will buy it, and they have asked some of the store managers to get that. It's just the fact is, it's cheaper for them to get the other things.
Mike?
Yeah, you know, I definitely agree that price is important, and it's important to educate people about healthy food. But the junk food industry's advertising works, and they spend a lot of money on it because it works. So in some way, they're creating the demand by going into these corner stores and setting up those displays at the front of the store, all the point of purchase advertisements, and it really pushing those products. In some ways, some of these corner stores are really just outposts for the junk food companies.
All right, let me Let me get through another phone call, another email. We haven't even talked about WIC. There's a lot that we haven't gotten into, but we'll try to get in as much as we can before the end of the hour. Margaret next up. Go ahead, Margaret.
Hi. This is just a gentle reminder to all of us that you can access year-round healthy, affordable foods at your local farmers markets. Thank Mitch for mentioning FoodLink's wonderful mobile and curbside markets. The City of Rochester Public Market and Brighton Farmers Markets are also open year-round. And I manage the market token program at the City of Rochester Public Market. This past year, we sold over $1 million of SNAP tokens combined with our New York State incentive program, which is a 40% coupon. A little bit different from Mitch's double up, but still a 40% benefit. So there's a wonderful opportunity, not just for our SNAP customers, but for all of us to take advantage of our local farmers markets. And I just want to encourage people to do that. And then also to comment on wise choices. We are also very much evidence-based. And when we evaluate our SNAP purchasing at the market, we can easily see that over 75% of the SNAP dollars go specifically to fruits and vegetables. And I'm wondering how many of us spend 75% of our food dollars at the grocery store on fruits and vegetables. And then another maybe 20% goes for meat, fish, dairy, breads, things like that. So even though there are a few unhealthy food choices at the public market, the vast majority of the SNAP purchases are for the healthy, especially fruits and vegetables. So I just wanted to thank Mitch for mentioning FoodLink's wonderful curbside and mobile markets and remind all of the listeners that there are farmers markets open year-round, and just don't forget about them in the wintertime.
Margaret, thanks for the phone call. Mitch?
And I just wanted to add on to that. So the public market, Rochester Public Market, South Wedge Market, Brighton Market, West Side Market, and FoodLink's Market all joined as a collaborative last year and started doing some collective marketing and branding, SNAP at the market, so the folks know that farmers markets are SNAP. That you can use SNAP at farmers markets. And I will say, Margaret was modest, but the Rochester Public Market is the number one leading SNAP retailer among farmers markets in the country, not in the state, in the country. It's a phenomenal place. It's open year-round, obviously. And yeah, we do talk about how there's a limited amount of options, but really, if folks look around and piece together these different options, there is quite a bit of SNAP-eligible entities to buy healthy food. Part of our job is to have to educate and promote and provide those opportunities. So things that both the Finger Lakes Health Systems Agency, Healthy Kids, and FoodLink have worked on is nutrition education and the Eat Smart New York program, making sure that folks know where to eat healthy, how to stretch your food dollars. That's a huge part of all this that unfortunately we won't have nearly enough time to talk about. But thanks, Margaret.
Well, I think I made a mistake by not at least explaining. People often equate or just understand that what we used to call food stamps, SNAP, but we should talk about what the acronym means. And you hear WIC, what that means. So SNAP stands for?
The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program.
And what is WIC?
It's Women, Infants, and Children.
Okay. And what should we know about the future of WIC then, Mike and Mitch?
Oh, that's that's the million-dollar question. So WIC is much more limited in who is eligible. You have to be a mother or a young child, an infant or a child, and it has a limited purview of, or you could be in the household with those individuals. It has a limited purview as far as what products you can purchase. So you can't buy sugary drinks. But you can get formula. You're supposed to be getting breastfeeding counseling and fruits and vegetables and so on and so forth. SNAP is basically anyone and purchasing it on a wide range of products. There's something like, at last tally, 45 million people on SNAP. So to your point, it's not just a Depression-era thing. It's a significant amount of people.
And it's not just harder to It's not just harder to get on SNAP as a customer, but also as a vendor. This is something Mike and I have worked on collectively, is trying to help stores accept WIC benefits. And part of the reason for that is that they've done a good job of making sure that WIC fraud is really minimal. Now, if you read enough newspapers locally and otherwise, you'll find SNAP fraud at corner stores all the time. And this is something that we all know there's ultimately a black market for selling SNAP benefits and trading it for this, that, and the other. WIC is incredibly difficult, and it does specify items that are all, well, at least mostly really good high health items, but it's harder to administer. So I think that what they need to probably do, and they will work on hopefully, is bringing the two things closer to the middle, where there still is some more distinction between what you can use, but it's not just a free-for-all.
Right. And the difficult thing is that as massive spending programs, and I should say that the fraud and trafficking is a very small percentage, though it's a very large program. But as these massive programs, they're targets for budget cuts and you know, the fiscal hawks and things like that. And so it's careful to distinguish between improving programs and cutting programs that people rely on.
Yeah. I'd agree more.
About 45 seconds, Mary Jane writes and says, I read that Amazon will be accepting food stamps beginning this summer. Is that right? What does this mean for area residents who are SNAP users and for local stores that accept SNAP? I don't know the answer to that.
They're going to be accepting for groceries.
USDA has approved a pilot project that mm-hmm. actually includes Hart's local groceries mm-hmm. to accept online orders for SNAP. So SNAP can't be used for the delivery, but you can purchase groceries online and they will deliver it for a fee on top of that, which obviously is great for people who have mobility issues, senior citizens who make up a large percentage of SNAP recipients. Amazon as well. I know other, I think there's seven in total.
Look, the world of grocery is changing. I mean, we even see this with all the stuff with Blue Apron and stuff. The critical thing, I think, for all of us is to make sure that there's still advocates at the table talking about people who come from low-income backgrounds.
Listeners, once again, we've tried to post in several places, not only the New York Times story, but some of the rebuttals to it. I want to thank our panel. You want to learn more about what they're doing? Where should people get online, Mike?
HealthyKids.org with an I. Healthy with an I?
Healthy with an I. HealthyKids.org. Mitch?
FoodLinkNY.org. And also, Evan, while I'm here, I'm going to say on air that I got to get you in to see our new kitchen.
It's on me now.
Yeah, it's on you now.
Okay.
I'm bringing you in for a tour.
I'm going to be there.
All right.
And Leverett, we'll see you again. All the great work that you're doing in your part of Rochester. And I just want to thank you for coming in here and sharing your story as well.
No problem. Anytime.
All right. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, and Megan Mack, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great afternoon. And tomorrow is, well, there's an inauguration. We're not going to be here because NPR National. I'll talk to you Monday on Member Supported Public Radio.